From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As Congress debates legislation on airport security, workers and community groups say real security means higher wages and more rights for airport employees. In an unforgiving national climate, radical-turned-community activist Sarah Jane Olson pleads guilty to charges she planted a bomb decades ago but claims she's not guilty of the charges. We'll speak with her. And Beyond the Burqa, a look at a film about life for Afghan women living under the veil of Islamic fundamentalism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Afghan opposition forces say today they're advancing steadily toward the key northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif with the help of round-the-clock U.S. bombing. Both sides said fighting was intense south of Mazar, which the Taliban seized from the opposition Northern Alliance in 1998. Taliban Bakhtar News Agency said U.S. jets bombed in eastern Kunar province yesterday, killing three civilians, injuring six, flattening an empty school. The White House, meanwhile, put new emphasis on the humanitarian aid it's providing Afghanistan. President Bush said after a meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, quote, "We talked a lot about making sure that our great compassion for the innocents in Afghanistan is fulfilled," adding, "We must feed the people." Humanitarian groups around the world have condemned the bombing, at least pleading with the U.S. and Britain to stop now so that aid can be rushed to the estimated 7 million Afghans at risk of starvation in the coming months. White House senior advisor Karl Rove will meet with top-level Hollywood executives on Sunday to hammer out an entertainment industry agenda for aiding the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. At the instigation of the White House, invitations were sent to the president of the Motion Picture Association of America, Jack Valenti, Viacom Entertainment CEO, Jonathan Dolgan, Paramount Pictures Chair, Sherry Lansing, and Rupert Murdoch. The invite subsequently went out to the owners and CEOs of the various studios and networks, most of whom quickly agreed to attend. A key figure in arranging the session was Gerald Parsky, who ran the Bush campaign in California. The press will be barred from the Sunday summit, which will take place at a Beverly Hills hotel. One executive who planned to attend the meeting likened the effort to those that followed Pearl Harbor, but insisted Hollywood can contribute in positive ways without becoming a propaganda organ. In related news, the House of Representatives yesterday, by a near unanimous vote, approved a measure to establish a radio-free Afghanistan to broadcast news and explain U.S. war aims to Afghans in their local languages. Supporters said the broadcasts, which cannot be aired in the United States since they constitute state propaganda, were needed to get the truth to the Afghan people. Some Congress members have been critical of the Voice of America, which purports to offer straightforward news, for not advocating the U.S. position strongly enough. Said Pennsylvania Democrat Congressmember Joseph Huffel, quote, "We must blanket the people of Afghanistan with the voice of freedom, truth, and democracy, as we blanket the Taliban with bombs." Israeli lawmakers voted to lift the parliamentary immunity of Azmi Bashara, an Israeli Arab legislator, so he can be prosecuted for remarks urging resistance to Israel and for arranging visits by Israeli Arabs to Syria, with which Israel is technically at war. It was the first time a lawmaker has been stripped of his immunity for political statements. At a memorial gathering in Damascus last June after the death of President Hafez al-Assad, Bashara called for broadening, quote, the path of resistance to Israel. He denies he incited violence and says he supports the right of Palestinians to struggle against Israeli occupation. After weeks of frequent, often tumultuous briefings by Taliban officials, Pakistan's government this week formally asked Taliban diplomats to stop holding news conferences at the Afghan embassy to denounce U.S. military attacks. The request reportedly followed complaints from U.S. officials about the briefings on the embassy lawn, at which Taliban envoys describe U.S. bombs hitting hospitals and schools and defending Osama bin Laden and claiming the United States States is using chemical and biological weapons to flush him out of his Afghan hideout. In addition, Pakistani newspapers reported the government has clamped down on domestic broadcasts by Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based satellite television network that has regularly broadcast video of alleged bombing damage in Afghanistan and statements by bin Laden.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one flipping burgers. The grills were cold. Onion rings were in their bags. Fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the trucks. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. Workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tights, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
David Rovix, live in our Firehouse studio. Well, speaking of people going on strike and union matters, a federal judge yesterday blocked enforcement of an executive order signed by President Bush that would prevent federally funded contracts from including agreements between employers and unions setting wages, benefits, and hiring conditions. The Building and Construction Trades Department of the AFL-CIO had sued the Bush administration, claiming the executive order violated the rights of employers and unions protected by the National Labor Relations Act. You're listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congressional negotiators met yesterday to try and reconcile competing bills on airport security, but adjourned without agreement after only an hour. The House and Senate have been unable to agree on the key issue of whether thousands of airport security workers should be put on government payrolls. The Senate last week unanimously passed a bill that would federalize airport security workers. Days later, the House passed a bill that would keep private contractors in charge of airport workers, but bring them under tighter federal regulation. The bitter congressional fight, however, has obscured real differences in the labor movement over how best to organize airport workers. Community groups involved with airport workers say the debate has also obscured the question of how wages and working conditions affect airport security. Ken Jacobs is on the line with us, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project. Can you lay it out for us?
Sure. The most important issue or issues around security at the airport for the workers have to do with wages and working conditions. At San Francisco International Airport, when we and unionization, when we started here over 2 years ago, we were dealing with a situation where baggage screeners were earning $6.25 an hour, and many of them were working multiple jobs. So you'd have a person like Rolando Pindon, 71 years old. He would get to work 9 p.m., work till 7 a.m. screening bags, have an hour off, work another 8-hour security shift, go home and get 2 hours of sleep at night. Under those conditions, it's impossible for anybody to do the work right. At the same time, people aren't given the level of breaks they need but there's between screening and other jobs, so that their eyes can stay focused and people can really focus on their work. By organizing it at the airport, wages at SFO are now up for screeners, was $10 and now it's up to $13 an hour. Turnover has dropped from over 100% a year to down to now 18%, which means before it was a situation where your average screener stayed on the job for, had been on the job for about 4 months because you could make more by going to work at McDonald's. Now you've got a situation where the wages are higher and people are staying, which means you have more experienced workers, which has had a direct impact on how many violations people are finding. The problems that are coming out in some of these bills are, one, it's San Francisco International Airport. We recognize that security is not just about baggage screeners. It's about all workers with access to the tarmac, all workers who touch the bags, and the living wages that we want at the airport were for all of those workers. Two, the bill in San Francisco, the House bill, includes provisions saying workers cannot be citizens, which is quite serious. 71% of the screeners in San Francisco are Filipino. These are people who are generally highly skilled, even potentially overqualified based on the jobs they had at the Philippines. The problem has not been the work that they do. It's not the workers, it's the working conditions. So, three, the Senate bill, which is has the federalization, also contains serious restrictions on organizing. And one of the most important areas for ensuring security is that workers need to be able to complain, need to be able to bring up problems without fear of retaliation. To do that, they need a union environment. So say that neither of these bills directly and correctly address fully the questions of wages, the questions of this issue about citizenship, which is a problem, the breadth of who needs to be covered around security, nor the question of guaranteeing that people actually have a voice on the job.
The way the debate has been portrayed in the press is that the House, led by basically Dick Armey, sort of speaking on this issue, does not want the workers to become members of unions. That's what they sort of equate totally as being federalized. What do you think about that, and what do the unions see this as a division between the House bill and the Senate bill that was overwhelming? It was 100-0 right. For federalizing the workers.
No, that's right. But also, what's been responded by folks in the Senate to Dick Armey is, don't worry, we put in provisions that are going to seriously restrict workers' voice on the job. So neither of these bills addresses what's needed in terms of workers having a voice on the job. And SEIU has successfully organized workers in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, where they have succeeded in significantly raising wages, changing working conditions, and giving people a voice on the job, which has had a dramatic impact, like we said, in turnover, which directly relates to performance. So SEIU's argument has been the federalization versus not is the wrong debate. The debate is guaranteeing workers a voice on the job.
Ken Jacobs with us, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project, recently completed a study on the impact of higher wages on airport security. We're also joined on the telephone by Tom Martin, who's a skycap at San Francisco International Airport for the past 17 years. What exactly do you do, Tom?
I've been a skycap. I work curbside and check bags and serve people out on the curb.
If you could speak as loud as you can and directly into the phone, I'm having a little trouble understanding you.
Okay.
Can you talk about what a living wage would mean for you? I mean, what do skycaps now make?
Well, we were included in the the quality standards program, so we are now up to $10 an hour. Previously, we had made minimum wage plus whatever we made in tips, which is not guaranteed income, so... been quite an improvement.
how did the living wage movement affect efforts to organize at the airport?
Well, it was very beneficial in that it was kind of a 1-2 punch, if you will. By working with the Living Wage Coalition, we were able to get people involved in the process of trying to deal with management as far as having a voice and getting them to realize that they were able to express their concerns and problems to management, and that there were things that could be done that would improve working conditions and our situation at the airport. And because of that, they saw that they were able to have a voice, and that the best solution to our problems was to organize and have unions that would represent us as far as being able to express our concerns and problems and not have to worry about being retaliated by management.
Why is unionization, do you see becoming a member of a union, important for airport security?
Well, primarily because it helps in, guarantee working conditions and pay, and also very important that creates a voice for the workers on the job. Without a voice, people are intimidated by management and feel that they'll be fired if they bring up any kind of issues or problems with the job. And with the union, they don't have to fear that and feel more able to address the problems that there are there, which I think is very important, especially in terms of security, because we have to find some way to solve the problems.
What does it mean to be an airport worker and to be a union activist? Are they cracking down on you at the airport? Are people being fired?
Well, there has been some retaliation for our organizing efforts and also the Living Wage campaign, actually. It's pretty much the usual battle, I guess, as far as management not wanting to or insisting that they can't afford to increase people's pay and improve working conditions and things like that. That'll put them out of business and things. And what we found, of course, is that that is not true. That has not happened. And in fact, some of the companies that were resistant and fought the idea of increasing pay and improving working conditions are now trumpeting the idea, saying that they go along with this or are for this because it has improved their ability to attract better people and to retain people. So eliminates the cost to them of having to retrain people all the time and to give people new uniforms and all of the costs that are incurred by the whole process of employing new people. So they are now a lot of them.
Finally, Tom Martin, what is it like to be a SkyCap at the airport since September 11th? In what ways have has your life changed?
Well, it was a pretty dramatic change initially. We were closed curbside for several weeks, and fortunately, common sense dictated that because we had the same security procedures as the folks that work inside at the counter, the agents, that it was really a perception problem more than anything else. So they allowed us to open up again, but business is slow, so it has impacted our incomes. But we are feel fortunate that we're back at work and we are working again. So we have some of the contractors have us doing other things besides doing our SkyCap jobs, checking people's tickets at the checkpoint before they go to the gates and things like that. So we've had to pick up some other security-related jobs, but we're back and forth between doing that and working out on the curb.
Ken Jacobs, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project, as we wrap up, what do you think are the greatest misunderstandings about the whole issue of airport workers now, security, and the legislation that is being passed now?
One, that airport security is not just a question of baggage screeners. There's a whole series and train of workers who touch the bags, who have access to the planes, who have access to the tarmac. If we are serious about airport security, we have to be serious about the wages of and working conditions of all those workers. Two, that this question of the citizenship of security workers is just a wrong question. We've got, like I said, 70% of the screeners in San Francisco are Filipino. These are dedicated immigrants. They're dedicated people who have the capacity to do a good job once the working conditions are there. And putting forward a bill that would toss out all of those people would be a disaster for security at the airport. And three, if we're serious about security, workers have got to have a voice on the job, and that means they've got to be able to unionize. And neither bill addresses that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Ken Jacobs, director of the Bay Area Organizing Project. If people want to get a hold of the report, where can they go on the web or call?
The website with me. To get a hold of the report, it's on the website for the Institute for Industrial Relations at the University of California at Berkeley.
And we'll have that information at democracynow.org. And folks, you can listen to us at wbix.org, at webactive.com, and at our newly launched website, thanks to Jackie Suen. And that is democracynow.org with all phone numbers and website information. Tom Martin, also thanks for being with us. SkyCap at San Francisco International Airport for the last 17 years. When we come back from our break, we're going to look behind the burqa. We're going to look at a film that is out on women in Afghanistan. And we are also going to be speaking with Sarah Jane Olson. She recently pled guilty to involvement in a planned bombing, but then when she left the courtroom, as she said, she had felt she was forced into that situation because of the climate of our times, and that in fact she's innocent. We'll have a conversation. Stay with us. Edwin Starr, War, here on Stop the War Now, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S.-led coalition against terrorism promises that a draft U.N. Security Council resolution would stress the responsibility of a transitional government in Afghanistan to eradicate human rights violations, as well as terrorism. The U.N. Special Envoy has said that any post-Taliban government would, quote, reflect the will of the Afghan people. But President Bush, Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain, and the UN Security Council have not demonstrated they'll insist on specific guarantees for the rights and representation of Afghan women. There's been no mention of women's participation in decisions on future governance in Afghanistan. Last March, well before September 11th, brought Afghanistan to the world's attention, Ayara Lee traveled to Afghanistan to make a short film about women's lives. She stayed with and interviewed members of the Afghan group HACA, Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. And she joins us in our Firehouse studio now. Welcome.
Hello.
Is that how you pronounce the name of the group?
HACA, Humanitarian Aid for Women and Children in Afghanistan.
And how did you find this group?
It's, you know, chain reaction of meeting here and there. Sundance Institute, they had done a documentary series, and they had invited people from Bosnia, countries in conflict, and they did a documentary a session for the festival. And Nicole Guilleme had put me in contact with some of the people there, and then I visited and we did a tour. We went through Peshawar and then Khyber Pass, Torkan. Orzala from HACA, she is just a woman who moved from Afghanistan to Peshawar to Pakistan, where we have over 2 million refugees. And she opened this school for street kids. And unlike the madrasas where kids are indoctrinated, fundamentalism, she tries to have a school where she teaches history, science, language, and the normal curriculum, non-religious curriculum. And, you know, this is not an institution. This is just a woman's effort to do something for her country. Obviously, she had lost her brothers and parents through the war, and that's what she was telling me. The problem is if you don't allow women to work, but then all the women are widowed because they lost their husbands in the war, what are they supposed to do to feed their children? So she's been very involved in the women's movement, but it's a non-political movement. This, in contrast to Rawa, who is a very political movement.
Well, Yara Lee, let's take a look at the film that you did. I should say that we are a collaboration of public community access TV stations and public radio. And so the people who are listening on radio and the internet right now will hear the voices. People on the Dish Network, Free Speech TV's Channel 9415, and public access TV stations around the country will watch this. And it actually, your film Beyond the Burqa begins with Orzala Ashrali, the founder of the organization HACA, Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. Let's take a listen.
International community in general, I mean the people of the world in general, they're always talking about human rights, women's rights, and they always condemn the violation of human rights. But I think Afghanistan is a country today that the word of human rights doesn't exist.
I believe that this is the time that the world should come forward and help the Afghans, because the Afghan war is not a civil war. It has got a lot of regional and international involvement. The thing is, we've got Central Asia in the north, we've got China, we've got Pakistan and Iran. Now, Afghanistan is the center of international Islamic terrorism, drugs production, and all these fanatic kind of ideologies. A lot of people fled Afghanistan not because of hunger or because of cold. We have had all these problems for 20 years. But a lot of people are escaping because they're threatened to be killed by the Taliban. Not these people. They're willing their children to die from cold and hunger in the refugee camps in Pakistan, but they don't want to stay under the Taliban regime.
Today we are in our worst moment of the history of our country. They started to destroy even the statues, even the heritage of our country, which is value not only for Afghanistan but for the world.
Before the Islamic Revolution, women got membership in the parliament. We have women engineers, doctors. But then when the extremist Taliban came over, they forced the women completely to stay away from any kind of social engagement, like working outside or studying in the colleges. They even closed down the primary schools for the women. It's a system to make slaves. And I think it's a very clear, you know, gender apartheid.
Wearing burqa is a part of our culture. But before the arrival of Taliban, it was on your own choice. But now the difference is that you have to. You might be sick. You, as she says, I have to wear glasses. I can't put my glasses on the burqa or under the burqa. Now all the women are prohibited from working. It's a very big problem because most of the families in Afghanistan have lost their male members in the fightings. The women cannot go to the market. You cannot go to a doctor, especially to a male doctor. And a woman's voice should not be heard by men. It's nonsense. Everything, nothing is left for the new generation. And the new generation is growing to be a wild one.
I have a life to serve my country.
Sir,
how are you going to serve your country?
Nah, jangi, fighting.
Oh God, he's going to be pilot with fighting jets.
Against my enemies.
That's why you're learning English.
Yes.
He is trying to guide the American people to become Muslims.
Are you a Taliban?
Yes, I'm a Taliban.
Did you hear that they destroy all the Buddha statues?
Wait, daddy, what are you doing? That the Buddha Bamiyano does in a harab kridi.
Yes, it's good.
It's good? Well, good.
Yes.
Akhuzumunga stasu farhangu, akhuzumunga stasu malkiwa.
The Islami Shariat.
He says that, well, this is Islamic Sharia, and this is the saying of our holy prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon him, that the statues everywhere should be destroyed. He says that I studied this from the Islamic books. I have to say that the school where he is studying is the school by some fundamentalists. That's why he learned all these things. There are two kinds of education in Afghanistan at the present. One kind is schools that are running by some supporters of fundamentalists, restricted for women. But the other kind of schools is, for example, we have also a primary school for children in which we mainly try to help learn mathematics, science, and English as a language. The teachers of our school are never allowed to talk about politics in the classes, to talk about guns. We just encourage them to love peace, to not fight with each other, to not think that the best toy for the children is gun. HACA is the acronym for humanitarian assistance for the women and children of Afghanistan. And it is it has been established in January 1999. This is a non-profit-making, non-governmental and non-political organization, which is mainly work in five different fields, such as education, healthcare, income generation, sanitation, and counseling. Try to keep your children clean. Try to wash their hands before lunch and after going to toilet. And try to teach your children to wash their face and their hands all the time. Most of the diseases that you people have is mainly because you don't care about your cleanliness. If you wash your hands, you can not be suffering by different diseases like diarrhea.
This is stent for malnutrition, for malnourished child. We are providing the supplementary food for the malnutrition as well. And we are giving the health education for the mother of malnourished child. This is stent of minor surgery, and we are providing facility for dressing as well.
What happened to this child?
He burned 1 week ago. We have the medicine for the main disease, but the death rate is one per day. One per day, yeah.
It is very difficult to help these children to get education because most of them are working daily. Half time they are working. and another half they are coming to the school. Some of them are working in carpet weaving. Some of them are working in the automobile workshop. Some of them are working as servant in some landlords' houses. And some of them are looking the garbages to collect some plastics, as you say. You can find hundreds of doctors, engineers, teachers who had a normal life in Afghanistan, but now they were forced to leave their country and they were forced to live in Pakistan. And since there are a large number of refugees come in one time, it's very difficult for them to find a job or to find a good place to stay.
Well, now the profession of the family is making bird cages, making some kind of typical Afghan drums, and with this money they make their living. The lady is saying that when the Russian went out, we felt that maybe there is security and there is peace in Afghanistan. And when we went back, we found that they are worse than Russians. Now there is no peace, there is fighting. The Taliban are killing their own countrymen, and the life of Afghans are not safe over there. Always trying to tell them that we understand that you are poor people and there is no need to have this hospitality with us. We understand everything. But even besides of insisting, they made the tea and they bought this typical Afghan tea with biscuits.
There have been a lot of educated people in Afghanistan, a lot of people who can be trusted, a lot of people who are working and fighting for democracy, for freedom of people, for freedom of women. So right now, I think it's very good for the international community to come forward and help the Afghans.
We urge our friends living in the Western countries to convey the message of the people who are apparently alive, but their spirit is dead.
Beyond the Burqa, Ayara Lee, filmmaker. A documentary that was done about the organization HACA, which is Humanitarian Assistance to the Women and Children of Afghanistan. The main site of the film was where again, Ayara Lee?
Kaipirinha.com.
Then the main site of yes.
We shot at the Jalazai refugee camp where the plastic tents are.
And that is where?
In Peshawar,
Pakistan.
Yeah, border city with Afghanistan.
And have you been in touch with women and specifically Urzala Ashrali since the bombing began in Afghanistan?
Yeah, since March we've been doing benefits throughout the country. We did in San Francisco, New York, L.A. We're doing one in L.A. and possibly the film festival in January, the Sundance. And basically, we work with a lot of women's organizations and grassroots organizations, fundraising for them. So periodically, we send funds.
And have you been in touch with?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what are they saying are the effects of the bombing?
Obviously, this is not a legal war, and this is not what we call smart bombs. This is what we call dumb bombs. There is the women and the population of Afghanistan, they are as victims of the Taliban as everybody else. So there's absolutely no point of randomly bombing Afghanistan. There is a lot of anger because obviously the Taliban are bad news, but not enough to justify what we are doing now. And there is all this propaganda now, and I am always concerned about showing my film because I don't want the film to be used to justify the bombing. For so long, nobody cared about the women's rights, and all of a sudden, CNN is showing films.
bringing up the rape women and all that, but not because they care about the women, because they're trying to justify what we are doing in their country.
And do you have any sense that women are being included in any discussion of a post-Taliban Afghanistan, or if there will be a post-Taliban Afghanistan, if the Taliban will remain in power?
Yeah, and that's what it is. I mean, we are not bringing the real issues, and we create our monsters. We created the Taliban. Now we're going to create another monster to go after the first monster. So now we go with the Northern Alliance, and it's just this vicious circle, you know. But the real issues are not addressed, you know, human rights violations and, you know, as Noam Chomsky says, what we are doing is silent genocide by allowing this to happen.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in. I know that this Sunday you will be having a discussion and a showing of the film at Galapagos Art and Performance Space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And for people who want to get more information on the film, you can go to ocularis.net. That's ocularis.net. You can also just go to our website and we'll have the information there, democracynow.org. Ira Lee, thanks for sharing the film with us. You are listening to The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Sarah Jane Olson talking about her case. She's just pleaded guilty in a California court, then walked outside and said she was innocent. Stay with us.
If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter for each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still my pen. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. But the stocks are going up somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra.
David Rovics, live in the Firehouse studio, and you can see more about him at davidrovics.com. That's davidrovics.com. Who David has just returned, actually, from Hartford, Connecticut, where he performed a benefit last night for people who were involved in an anti-war protest and were arrested. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An angry Los Angeles judge scolded Sarah Jane Olson yesterday for publicly flip-flopping on her guilty plea to attempted murder charges last week and made her enter the plea again, repeating in court that she was in fact guilty. The case of Sarah Jane Olson has drawn a lot of attention recently. Papers describe her case scream fugitive revolutionary and terrorist radical. Olson pled guilty to charges that she plotted 26 years ago to bomb two police cars 2 days ago in a Los Angeles hearing on her case. Sarah Jane Olson reiterated her guilty plea, but stated unequivocally that she neither possessed the bombs, constructed the bombs, nor placed the bombs under police cars, but she acknowledged guilt under the definition of aiding and abetting. At the unusual hearing, the Los Angeles judge scolded Olson for her behavior. We're on the phone right now with Sarah Jane Olson and her attorney. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Goodbye.
It's good to have you with us. Well, rather than me describe it, since I'm describing it from various reports, Sarah Jane Olson, why don't you tell us why you pled guilty, what you pled guilty to, and what you feel you are innocent of?
Well, I pled guilty because I had never intended to plead guilty, and I think that Sean will back me up on this with no problem. Even after the events of the Twin Towers and the Pentagon on September 11th, but I immediately realized after I watched in a horrified manner the Twin Towers collapse, I thought, oh, this is probably going to affect the public tremendously, and obviously the jurors in my case, and immediately started getting calls from friends and relatives and emails, numerous emails from members of my defense team saying that I should reassess my situation in light of September 11th. And it took me quite a while to come to terms with that, and finally I did begin listening to them. As they said, this is going to be very, very difficult. And then once the judge turned down our request for a continuance, saying that, you know, this had all been our fault strategically as a defense team, and constantly ignoring the fact that the DA had, over a period of time, at the last minute before we were going to trial, several times dumped enormous amounts of evidence on us, and then just basically said, good luck, try to wade your way through that and decide what we're going to use against you, that perhaps I had to reassess my situation. And so Sean spearheaded negotiations prior to my making the plea that just wound us down, backed us up against the wall more and more, and the DA said, well, what we're giving up is the conspiracy charge, which opens you up to a life sentence, so we expect you to basically give up everything else. And then after we signed the agreement in front of the judge, they reneged on that, too.
Let me give a little background for listeners. Prosecutors say that in 1975 that Sarah Olson, who we're speaking to right now, known then as Kathleen Scalia, was
Scalia. Nobody pronounces my name.
How do you pronounce it?
Scalia.
Was part of the Symbionese Liberation Army, a militant political group which committed a series of bank robberies and kidnappings and was accused of several murders. Six members of the group were killed by the police in 1974, after which SLA members allegedly tried to plant bombs on two police cars. At that time, you went underground, or shortly afterwards, took a new name, became a community activist in Minneapolis, and then were arrested 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you denying involvement in the bomb plot?
You know, this is Sean Chapman, her lawyer, and I'm sorry, I can't allow her to answer that question because, as you know, we have a sentencing coming up, and we also may have to deal with the parole board at some point in the future, so it would be wise for her to remain silent on that question.
What kind of sentence do you expect the judge to hand down?
Well, the judge will not hand down the sentence. He will simply tell her she must serve the term prescribed by law. The parole board will then set her release date, and we are certain that her release date will be set at 5 1/4 years, of which she will serve half.
So it would be about a little more than 2.5 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, Sarah Jane Olson, talk about what you were doing at that time? Talk about the Symbionese Liberation Army. I guess in the past, the description of the case against you that I heard was that it was basically lifting line, chapter, and verse from Patty Hearst's autobiography. Or the book about Patty Hearst, since she was also in the SLA at the time that you were.
Well, you know, Sarah is Sean Chamonix, and she was never a member of the SLA. We've always asserted that. She's always maintained that. And really, all that she did was give a passionate speech after her good friend, who had been a member of the SLA, was killed in that shootout on 54th Street. And she was contacted later by some members of the SLA to assist them. She gave them small amounts of money, but was never a member of the group, never participated in any violence whatsoever, and that's a very important distinction to make clear.
How is it that the prosecutors or the newspapers at that time portrayed it so differently? Can I ask that, Sarah Jane Olson? What do you think was their agenda?
Well, I suppose it was a big, juicy story. I mean, it's the same old story everywhere. You look at how things are portrayed today regarding the war or any aspect of it. You know, it's it's just whatever sells papers, and so the description of me today by most media is I remain as defiant as ever, you know, which gives me a laugh. I mean, it's just a matter of under a lot of pressure trying to retain a shred of one's dignity, and if that constitutes defiance, well, then so be it. However, it simply sounds better if I sound like a defiant bitch, you know, and so that's how they describe me. One thing that I do find very interesting is people have asked me over and over again, and this was suggested from the time that I was arrested, that perhaps my arrest, to some extent, has something to do with the LAPD trying to come up with a reason for why they were under so much fire at that time from the Ramparts, Rampart scandal. Ramparts is one of the divisions here in Los Angeles, and there is a station house, and many of the officers in that operating Rampart were accused of setting up individuals, planting evidence, beating them, and perhaps this is a way to deflect some of the attention from that to show how dangerous the police lives are. And yet 2 days after the judge lets my plea stand, the LA Times is trumpeting the headlines, DA says no new charges expected in Rampart probe. And of course all the defense attorneys are saying, but there's so many officers that are indictable, and they're saying, no, we should wrap this up now by the end of the year. We'll just let those other 100 cases go. So I thought that was exquisite timing, considering I didn't necessarily bring that up myself. So many other people did. I'm not suggesting they dumped this probe simply because I took a plea, but it is exquisite timing, I must say that. But in terms of talking about what I did or didn't do, I'm still facing, you know, being sentenced by the California Parole Board and doing time. I had to accept doing time to simply ensure the fact that I have a future, and that's because anybody will tell you, even the prosecution, that going before a jury is a dangerous proposition. You can have the best case in the world and at the wrong time or for any reason. And that's the wonderful thing about the jury system, is that perhaps you can get an acquittal, but on the other hand, you can also get the opposite.
We're talking to Sarah Jane Olson and her attorney, Sean Chapman, this just after. Well, you went into court in an unusual hearing, and this was the second hearing. I wanted to ask what you think of the judge's statement, the integrity of the criminal justice system demands, and the public confidence in it demands, that Olson make a choice. She cannot have it both ways. Then you having to go back into court made your statement to the judge on Tuesday. I did not make the bomb, you said, denying direct role in a bomb attempt to place a bomb under two police cars. You said, I did not make the bomb, I did not possess that bomb, I did not plant that bomb, but under the concept of aiding and abetting, I plead guilty. Fiddler then pressed you further because you are in fact guilty, and you responded, yes.
I had no choice. I didn't want to do that, but I really had no choice. This is a high-profile case, and people plead guilty to charges all the time, as you well know, for all kinds of reasons. Usually they involve just simply having something sure, like a sentence that you know there's an end to, or saving friends and family more anguish, or just not having enough money, all of which applied to me. And I think that if this weren't a case that was commented on afterwards so much in the press, because in the media generally, because it had some attention, mainly because the DA was bringing in Patricia Hearst, and I think that's the only reason this case ever got any comment. You know, it's just another American soap opera. They never ask why people really make decisions. They do it sometime in life. They just want to know who's going to bed with who, and that's what I think this was all about, basically. But, you know, it was a high-profile case, and I had to go in and do my penance for telling the truth as I saw it, and I shouldn't have done that. I was fat. And so I did it because even though it irked me, my attorneys are correct. It was the right decision probably to make. It's one of those things you never really know, but it's the decision we made, and we made them through arduous hours of these decisions of conversation and debate and anguish, and it wasn't something we just did overnight. Sean worked so hard for this, and I think afterwards felt a little terrible because it was so obvious, as the affidavit she and Stuart Hanlon and Sidney Crickard, another attorney in her office, and Mark Shattuck, the forensics expert on my case, said in their affidavits that we put on the court record that the DAs really had negotiated in bad faith and throughout the entire thing. And they really had nothing to say about it. They said that the affidavits made them feel uncomfortable. Well, at least that, I would hope. But, you know, it's a dead story now. Who cares? Now we're on to the next thing. And they got what they wanted, and I gave it to them because I'm just one person and I don't have any power, and I really had to preserve some future for myself.
Well, Sarah Jane Olson, I want to thank you for being with us, along with your lawyer, Sean Chapman. If people want to get more information on your case, where can they go on the web?
www.sarahjaneolsondefense.com or .org. There's a website there, and it has a tremendous amount of information about my case.
Thank you both again. And this news on the home front: the Pacifica National Board appears to have backed out of a mediated negotiation with plaintiffs who are suing the board for alleged illegal conduct, including severing accountability to local advisory boards, changing the bylaws, and hiding network finances. Last week, board members Bob Farrell and Marion Berry, the former D.C. mayor, represented the Pacifica National Board and mediated talks with the plaintiffs. Both sides announced a settlement had been reached and that the details would be made public within days. Marion Berry went on Pacifica Station KPFA's air and said the war at Pacifica is about to be over. But litigant Carol Spooner announced today that Pacifica has terminated the mediator's services. The Pacifica National Board will be meeting in Washington, D.C. on November 17th and 18th. There are many protesters who are expected to be gathering there as well. And that does it for today's program. Tonight I'll be out at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island at the Scholar Recital Hall for a speech by Laurie Garrett on bioterrorism. Tomorrow, heading out to Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio for a talk on Saturday night in Boston at the Orpheum. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We broadcast on the web at WBIX.org, democracynow.org, and webactive.com. Thanks to KPFA, Pacifica's first station, KFCF, and also to all the Pacifica affiliates who are running this program. We are Pacifica. Thank you to Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno, who are our hosts at the Firehouse. We're broadcasting on WFMU in New York. Broadcasting in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman, going out with David Rovix live in our studio.
They bombed Philadelphia, killed women and children and men. It's an old story, we see it again and again.